Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, July 13th, 1998. In the Creekside room this morning is Cheryl Ney. It's session number 98-6, and it's titled The Aims of Modern Western Science, The Case of Genetics. Let's listen in.
The Aims of Modern Western Science, The Case of Genetics. I'll be the facilitator here. My name is Cheryl Ney. I'm a professor in the chemistry department at Capital University, one of the 29 ELCA colleges and universities in Columbus, Ohio. And I did my training in DNA biochemistry, and I was a genetic engineer at one point in my life. So I just want to say, before we get started, genetics will be my theme all week. And one of the guides I use in my teaching when I talk about these issues is a wonderful book called Mapping Fate. It's written by Alice Wexler. It's an autobiographical and historical account of a particular genetic disorder. So it sort of chronicles understandings of Huntington's disease from about, well, actually, she goes all the way back to the 13th century, so not exhaustively way back, but I think it's a really nice account. If you're not familiar with any of the issues in here, and what's really nice about it, at least for students, is it's autobiographical, and it talks about your life. All right, so I'm told to mention that this book is available in that great Holden bookstore, so if you don't have anything to do out here in this wonderful environment, want something to read about genetics, all right, we're all prepared for you. All right, what I had in mind today was that we might start by defining what we're going to include under the realm of genetics. And then in discussion with you all, we can talk about current events in genetics. And as we think about these current events, we'll then go to ask what are the aims and goals behind the events that we're describing. And we might also then ask the question, whose aims and goals are these? And then we'll turn to some guidance from Evelyn Fox Keller, who's a PhD in physics, molecular biology, and now a historian of science. So we'll turn to some guidance from her and ask the question, what might be the long-term consequences that we can now see? Of course, there'll be consequences that we can't predict if these aims are followed. And then we need to end the session with the question, what might the theme for Holden Village's summer Guide Our Feet mean to our discussion? All right, so that's where we'll head. So I just wanted to start by just reminding us what we mean by genetics at this period in our history. That, of course, this would be something different at different times. But when we say genetics now at the end of the 20th century, what might we include? Certainly, many of you are aware of issues of genetic testing. We've got issues of gene therapy. There's lots of biotechnology going on that involves genes. And here's one of the hottest fields involving genetics right now would be the technologies that we have to use DNA in forensics. All right, so when I say genetics, I'm thinking about all those fields, plus traditional ideas of genetics. All right, so I thought a good way to get started would be just to find out what knowledge you all bring to this room. I should remind us that I recognize that I'm doing this presentation out of my perspective. Right, and I also recognize that you all have a particular perspective to bring. So what's wonderful about Holden Village is sort of how we're all enriched by these multiple perspectives. So really do want to take advantage of what your experiences are and what your expertise might be. So why don't we spend a few minutes thinking about genetics in the news? I've been here at Holden for a week, so I don't even know what the news is right now. But some of you more recent, what's going on in genetics in the news? What are some things that you've thought of in the past year, maybe, you've seen?
Gene therapy for angiogenesis.
Angiogenesis. Could you say something about what that's about?
Well, creating new blood vessels to increase the circulation, or also the opposite, to prevent blood vessels from forming on tumors.
Wow, and they're doing this?
it's being done. I can't remember the companies that are doing it.
Is it being used for human subjects?
Yes. I mean, it's at sort of the animal work is pretty much finished, and they're starting to. They tried it out on a few desperately ill patients for angiogenesis to as an alternative to amputation, really.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And do you know what the results of those?
It was very positive. Uh-huh. That they used this vascular endothelial growth factor to cause new blood vessels to form.
Wow.
in the limbs of a woman.
Wow. That sounds pretty promising.
Yeah.
Are you a scientist involved in that work?
Yeah, I've been working for 1 year at Megabionics, a gene therapy company that just went public in November.
Oh, how interesting. So you'll bring a particular perspective. Good, great. Other examples you can think of in the news involving genes, or that you yourself are aware of or a part of?
Was it Dolly? The sheep?
Yeah, Dolly.
Absolutely. And what's the U.S. equivalent? Haven't they done now a cow in the Midwest? They did a cow. Has that cow gotten a name?
And cows, mice, sheep.
Uh-huh. So since you're a practicing geneticist, can we ask you, is the controversy surrounding Dolly been sort of laid to rest? That is, the idea that perhaps she was formed from a fetal cell and not a maternal cell?
I don't know that.
You don't know about that. But you feel fairly confident that we could say that cloning of animals has been done.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, from non-fetal tissue.
From non-fetal tissue with no controversy.
Yes.
I mean,
yeah,
they're definitely coming from their.
I don't know about that particular case, right. but I know that it has been done from somatic mature cells.
Okay. Wow. Happy to hear that report. Okay. genetic events you can think of in the news. Past year or so. You got a favorite that you think of?
Well, just the continuing research into a genetic component to breast cancer.
Uh-huh, right, the breast cancer genes. And really just cancer in general, that whole area of the genetics of cancer has really opened up in the last couple of years, right? So we should say that in general.
There's an interesting forensic case in Seattle right now, too, where they're trying to prove a crime using the DNA of a dog that was also injured in the crime, and the blood was on the suspect.
Wow.
And so there's a big controversy about whether that, you know, that forensic DNA is proof enough.
Wow. So. Huh. All right.
I don't remember exactly, but isn't the Human Genome Project supposed to, like, complete some phase soon?
Is it 9? I think it's next year.
What phase is it that's going to be done?
I'm not real familiar with it.
Yeah.
I just remember that it was before 2000.
Yeah.
It's less than 1% that's done now.
Okay. So less than 1% of the human genome. Right. Other things that come across your eyes in terms of genetics.
Maybe the thing about gene transfer up there, from one transferring of genes from one cell to another.
Okay, are you thinking in terms of gene therapy, maybe?
Pardon?
Gene therapies? Is that what you're thinking of, where they take a gene and get it into cells?
Yeah, take a gene from one and put it, one animal, one cell, one person, put it in another, and correct things.
Okay, all right, gene therapies?
Yeah, gene therapy.
So there's another example, yeah. Gene therapies in general?
Genetic vegetables.
Would you like to say something about that? No. You're going to be in trouble now that you're here. Any other scientists in the room? We're going to call on you. Genetic genes and vegetables, how's that?
Yeah.
And can you give us an example?
Tomatoes that don't spoil.
Tomatoes that don't spoil. Other genetic news recently. Let's see.
Vaccines, I think people are, I don't know very specifically though.
Some kind of a genetic vaccine?
Yeah, just.
Wow.
What about the revelations in Switzerland about the eugenics program in the early part of the century?
Sweden.
The Sweden.
Sweden. Uh-huh. Hmm. Eugenics in Sweden, right. Is everyone familiar with that story?
No.
No.
They were involuntarily sterilizing people with genetic disorders to clean up the gene pool, or to keep, I think it was with people with mental disabilities and such. And the population were just aghast. You know, they couldn't believe, because their country has such a reputation for humanitarianism and social justice, and it's actually a socialist country, I believe. So they were just shocked that their government could do something like this.
Are they doing it recently?
No, it was done in the past.
Revelations.
It's been uncovered.
Yeah. Recent revelations about that this happened back in the early part of the 20th century, 1930s, 1940s.
And how it came about was some of the victims of this program were looking for compensation from the government, and so that's how it sort of fell out. Other examples you can think of. I was at a genetics conference a year ago where someone mentioned that they'd found a risk-taking gene in rats.
Oh, well, I didn't read about that. That's right. They're the gene that the rats that were more likely to take risks. And that's interesting.
Criminal behavior, I mean, that whole...
The whole controversy surrounding violence and genes.
Mm-hmm.
Can you say more about that, or shall I'll give it as dad?
No.
We got the headlines. There's so much information that comes at us. That's another problem. There was supposed to be a federally funded conference involving violence and genes, and there was some concern that the conference was just going to say strictly that violent behavior was related to genes, that it was determined, and there was an uproar, and they had to redo the program.
One example I have heard of that is the whole thing of men with two Y chromosomes, that they're...
Super
male. I don't quite remember.
Okay.
What the story was.
So there's a specific example. All right. Others. Wasn't there a report just really recently about something called the religiosity gene? That someone was speculating, or someone was narrowing in on something they were calling the religiosity gene? Narrowing in on the idea of genetic component behavior, genes and behavior. Right. Any other cases? And there was a remarkable case about aging and genes that are...
Well, telomeres, there's a company that seems to think that they can do something about aging, basically.
Right. And didn't they go straight to the press instead of through the peer review? Anyway, I remember when it came over on the news, what was so interesting about it was that unlike other news accounts, the news commentator, the science commentator, went on to explain that this was coming out of a company. And, you know, usually you don't hear the perspective of the people doing the work and what have you. So I thought that was the first case I'd ever seen where NBC News was saying a little bit
marketing.
About perspective. Yeah, right, marketing, using the news to market. Oh, what a novel idea. All right. All right, so certainly there's a lot being done daily, every day, and something new comes out every day. I thought we might take some time to think about what's behind these things. What are some of the aims that come out of this kind of work? What are the aims or goals?
Improve our life.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What aspects of life?
Health.
How about safety? Right, if you're going to tie violence to genes, or if you're going to look for the risk-taking gene.
Sure.
All right.
Social engineering.
All right, so you're thinking of the eugenics case. Mm-hmm. Right. Certainly that issue of eugenics, it's a difficult one in Germany, right? People, sort of the politics of genetics is much different in Germany than it is here in the U.S. However, one thing Alice Wexler, who's a historian, reminds us is that we did have a eugenics program in the United States, which many scientists are not familiar with. The scientist who started Cold Spring Harbor, Charles Davenport, set up a eugenics record office in 1910. Because this was a whole age in which, you know, being fit was sort of a prime social value. And so at the turn of the century, we wanted to have a fit society. And so we do have a record in this country.
And in fact, the Germans modeled their eugenics program, their legislation, after an American case called Buck v. Bell, where I can't remember what state it was on the Eastern Seaboard, set up a program for involuntary sterilization of mentally retarded. Mm-hmm. And the Germans seized on that particular legislation as a model for their own.
Wow.
So you just something you don't hear about. Buck versus Bell, if you're ever interested in looking at that.
It was a case of a mentally retarded person being involuntarily sterilized?
Right. Mm-hmm. And not just one, but successive generations. You know, they were afraid that the offspring of certain mentally handicapped person mm-hmm. were going to carry that disorder on with them. So they, mm-hmm. what ended up happening is they miscalculated and sterilized a daughter of the mentally retarded woman, and it turned out she grew up, she was fine. There was nothing wrong with her, so.
So it was her
case. So the legality of the whole state statute went up to the Supreme Court.
Wow. And what happened there?
They struck that legislation down. But not before the Germans seized on the notion of using that kind of legislation to further these interests.
Yeah, but unfortunately, this eugenicist and the people who worked in his office did promote this kind of sterilization, and also immigration laws were directed towards keeping out, keeping an eye to what kind of genes we were going to let into the country. Mm-hmm. All right, so we've got two goals, sort of on the different ends of the scale. Anything else that we want to say?
Just behind saying in the forensics, maybe justice.
Okay. The justice is a goal, forensics is an example. I can think of another case of justice, a very clever case done by Mary Claire King, who's a geneticist. I think she's in Washington, and she's at Berkeley. She went down on a project to work with the grandmothers in Argentina. When there was that repressive political regime, and parents were being carted off to jail, and mothers were having babies in jail, and the mothers and fathers were being killed, and the military officials were taking these children on as their own children, the grandmothers of the parents who had been killed in jail wanted to reconnect with their kin, and so they were using the latest in forensics, DNA forensics, to try to reunite families. And so I think that's a really nice example of. Interestingly enough, Mary Claire King started out working for Ralph Nader in Common Cause before she went to graduate school. So I'm thinking that that's perhaps where she picked up this bent. Other things behind.
I don't think this is happening yet, but there's been talk about companies testing prospective employees for mm-hmm. certain traits. Mm-hmm. Alcoholism or...
No, it happens already, isn't it?
I don't know. I haven't read any cases of trying to...
It's talked about anyway. Employers screening employees are using genetic testing.
Under the Americans with Disability Act, they have to make you a job offer first, then conduct medical screening afterwards. So that's kind of a roundabout way. You wouldn't think of the Americans with Disabilities Act protecting people who don't know that they have a disability.
What's behind that? What's the aim or goal behind that?
Maximize productivity.
Yeah, right. Getting fit workers.
Is it also to avoid insurance costs? I mean, mm-hmm. some companies carry their own.
Self-insured.
Mm-hmm.
maximize productivity. Other things you think are behind this blast of genetics here at the close of the 20th century. You were going to say something, Andrew?
Well, I thought of something that might be beyond the scope of what you're after, but there was this article in Newsweek a couple of years ago about mitochondrial inheritance that said that all maternal inheritance went back 100,000 years, and we had a common, the Eve hypothesis.
Right. So what's the aim behind that kind of research? What do you think?
Just basic knowledge.
Basic knowledge. Mm-hmm.
Just the drive to learn. Mm-hmm.
Do you think it's always the case when people are claiming that the aim is basic knowledge? Do you think that's always the primary motive? Sometimes it's a good cover, I think. Mm-hmm. For, yeah. What other aims?
Yeah. Scientific racism.
Okay. Mm-hmm. You want to say something about that?
Well, like, you know, it kind of stems back to the eugenics angle.
Right.
If we can prove that our gene pool has less, you know, problems with it or is superior in some way, then scientifically we can rationalize and say our ethnic group is superior to another. I can't think of any recent stories of that, although I know there have been some.
The last thing was that I mean, it was really big, was like Shockley and the black intelligence.
The bell curve, that kind of idea. Yeah, I went to a National Science Foundation funded meeting on race and science probably about 5 years ago. And what they were saying 5 years ago is that if you try to look at genes of any one race, the differences are so great with any, you know, population that you would pick. You find greater differences, so much variation within a group that you can't pick out a gene. You can't use skin.
That was one interesting basic point, was that it was sort of like that skin color was sort of a superficial trait.
Right.
You are much more related at other levels.
Right. That's sort of related to all of that is this idea of many people are wondering about issues of identity for themselves, and so some of the paternity stuff, even this, you know, wanting to know if there was a mother of us all back there that we're all related to, this sort of, I think maybe one of the aims behind that are identity issues. Yeah.
They're kind of strange, which is sort of taking control of evolution, and maybe like it'd be great if we could turn on the ability to produce vitamin C, for example.
Like dogs or something.
And I'm not endorsing evolution.
That's right.
You don't have to.
So when you say take on. Do gene manipulation so that we can produce our own vitamin C? Is that what you're, mm-hmm. the idea that you're talking about?
Similar kinds of things.
Uh-huh.
Really useful.
So really what you're, what we're thinking about here are more fit, increase the fitness of humans,
yeah, it's,
right?
It's related to health. But,
mm-hmm. Right.
Basically right now we just kind of leave it a chance. I wonder. But,
so really, I think the dominant word there is control, right? We're trying to control biology. Mm-hmm. Other values you think are behind?
There are some issues of ecology, the competing species that are that can be studied through like seeing speciation directly. And I haven't seen anything in the news about it, but I've always kind of wondered if there's any relationship between infertility and human speciation or anything of that kind. You know, it's
sort of as the evolutionary...
It's kind of like...
Darwinian kind of survival of the fittest kind?
Yeah,
of
I mean, it's almost amazing that all mankind is a single species.
Uh-huh. We think, anyway.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't uh-huh. make sense, really.
Uh-huh. Killed off all those other lines.
So maybe we're thinking again about some basic knowledge. You're asking sort of a question related to basic knowledge that we don't have, which if we found the answer to that question might lead to a whole host of other social implications as we move along. Other things you think at work in the area of genetics?
We do it to increase yields, crop yields,
okay.
Improve speed of growing your trees so they grow faster. And
hey, why do we want to do that?
Because, well, to make more, make a bit of land produce more crop, you don't have to have as much land growing crops, or you're going to serve more people.
So we're back to that idea of increasing productivity. Is that what you're suggesting? Mm-hmm. Or effectiveness of in agriculture? We saw that up here with our employers. Yep.
I think kind of following up on that a little bit, the profit motive. Certain products will be developed sooner than others because there's a wider population that will benefit. And
absolutely,
we have to think about the fact that we live in a capitalistic society, and what checks and balances are in place on these corporate ventures into this domain of life.
If you make it cheaper, faster, and more of it.
Right. It might also include who gets the patent rights.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Who owns this new knowledge?
Oh, yeah. Or who owns the genome?
Right.
You can't use that gene anymore.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But on the trip up here, I was reading where they were. They are trying to change agriculture in some places, going from annuals to perennials, and all the things, and trying to make the perennials produce as much as the annuals produce. So there is some research, and I just remember skimming an article driving up here.
Is that related to the idea of sustainable agriculture?
Yeah.
That when you move to perennials, you're getting more sustainable agriculture?
Yeah, and you don't use up the soil as much. And
uh-huh. Uh-huh. I don't know quite where to put that. Maybe, I don't know. It's kind of the opposite.
It's another approach to productivity.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. Another approach to productivity. Other things you think are behind all this stuff about genetics right now? What do you suspect? Yeah.
No, it was sketching.
Okay.
Technology drives everything. I mean, it's sort of it's the ability to do things is more important than the interest in doing them.
Why is that? Why do you think that's true? Why do you think technology is driving things?
Well, I don't think technology would drive it if there wasn't money involved. Especially in this field, but doesn't it take a pretty large capital investment to make progress? I don't know what's required in the lab.
Yeah, it does take capital. I think it's more like the history. It's like, you know, business machines to computers, and mm-hmm. computers to computing and all the sciences.
But we could do that because of the capital.
Yeah, that's right. It's the relation between commercial values and where basic science goes, and then once the basic technology is developed, it gets applied to every place. That, like, nobody would ever invent a computer to do well. They wouldn't have.
What about, think of the copper mine here as an example of this process of technology driving and profit related to that and capitalism related to that.
Setting up the cap here.
I mean, imagine the capital it took. I mean, the amount of energy that is used not only to get the ore out of the mine, but you think of the people energy and
rails.
You know, the cost of getting those damn pool tables up here.
We did enjoy it.
Well, there's some return in that investment, but certainly it took a lot of capital to even set this place up, right? Do you think there's any way in which the story of the mine at Holden Village can inform thinking about new technologies? Certainly there must have been new technologies at the time. You know, how do you get ore out of the mountain and down the lake in the beginning of the 30s? when they did that. And then look at the result. Here, what, how many years later? Almost 50 years later. Mine closed in the 1950s. You know, is there the possibility of a metaphor or some guidance there on using that model? All right, so I think we've pretty well exhausted and really gotten down to the roots of some of these aims and goals, and I think as we've listed them out, we've been pretty fair, right? There are some that are on the what we might consider on the good end of the spectrum, and some on the other end of the spectrum, which are problematic, right? And this idea of this, there's always this tension, it seems to me, between the goodness and the difficulties that come out of enterprises such as these in science. Right? All right. I wanted to turn to looking to what Evelyn Fox Keller and Bill Moyers have to say, particularly about aims in science, particularly related to genetics. And it happens that this discussion comes up in the context of gender, which is something we really haven't gotten to in our listing out of what we think are behind these aims. And I kind of tried to lead us into thinking about moving in that direction by asking the question, well, whose aims and goals, as we've listed them out before, whose are these? Right? Who's decided that we're going to go for social engineering, or we're going to go for justice, or we're going to go for improving the fitness of our employees? Whose aims and goals are these? And I think this is a sort of a foundational question that we don't often really examine. So one way into asking that question is to ask about issues of race, class, and gender. When we list out things like aims and goals, whose lives are we going to improve?
From the belief that it's technology-driven, I think it has to do with who gets the most education and becomes the scientist, either inside academia or inside businesses, that give the executives the options of what could be done.
Right, so education
so
is the
education.
And also, I think the argument can be made that there are certain values embedded in science itself that are shaping this process. For example, I sort of gave an indication of that when I made that comment about Mary Claire King. You know, most of us in science, A, we don't get any history of science, B, we're never taught any philosophy of science, and we never, hardly ever sit around talking about the ethics, justice issues, and things like that, because that's not part of the mainstream values related to science. Right? And so I think a lot of the values that are seen in our list here are coming out from the values of who gets, as you suggested, who gets to make these choices and who gets to choose what basic research to do. Mm-hmm. All right? So why don't we try to pick up on the conversation here to maybe push us a little bit further. And the way we do that is, so I've asked the question, whose aims and goals are these? How can we get into this? The way that Evelyn Fox Keller has gotten into answering these questions is to simply look at the language that's used in science, or the language that's used in marketing, or the language that's used in the description of all this kinds of genetics. Because if you look at language, you can find out values. That language is the mediator of our ideas, of our values. And so by looking at the language, we can begin to raise questions about whose values these are. And so I think with that, we can pick up on the conversation here. You can see I'm trying to set it up for you. It's kind of an awkward spot. We're going to start at the part of the conversation where Bill Moyers is asking her about what she thinks about the atomic bomb. All right, so that was a big scientific issue. It still is. And often there's this correlation made between the issues surrounding the bomb and issues surrounding genetics. And so as you hear the words about bomb, you could just put in the words of genetics and see what happens. All right, so there'll be a little bit about that, and then you'll hear them specifically talk about the aims behind the genetics, at least by Evelyn Fox Keller's perspective. Right? Anything else I can help you with as we jump in with this? So really we want to get at, these are the aims, whose aims are they, what aims should we strive for? Yeah?
One piece of science history that I'm missing is is a reason that the Human Genome Project is an Atomic Energy Commission project, and the French Atomic Energy Commission is also big in the Human Genome Project.
Yeah, my understanding of that history is that when the bomb was dropped in Hiroshima, some clever biologist said this would be a great laboratory for looking at the effects of radiation on human genes. And that's how the DOE got involved. That they wanted to quickly devise a way to be able to analyze the DNA of the radiation victims. So that's how it started. That's how the project started in this country. And continues, the DOE continues to support the project heavily. Values lady comment there. All right, I think you go ahead and hit the lights. Let me just hit this on in case anybody wants to look over here. And then we have this one over here. Now this is more energy and capital involved in TVs up the mountain. Here we go, up the valley.
As a feminine virtue, as a feminine talent that has been excluded from science.
Can you give me some specific examples? I mean, I can think it's a very obvious one. I think of the first atomic bomb was called Fat Boy, and it was delivered from the womb of a bomber named Enola Gay, a female delivering a weapon of destruction. But that's probably too.
It's been extraordinary, that metaphor. I mean, what do you make of it? And that was a metaphor that really...
I really think that men were at war and men were the scientists who invented the atomic bomb, and they gave it the name that would give something if they were playing in a schoolyard.
Yes, except that the idea of the metaphor of the bomb as baby is to me more than something a kid would do in a schoolyard. I mean, that carries for me far more import.
And as you pointed out, the bombs with the thrust are called boy babies,
that's
and
right.
the
that's
bombs
right.
that were duds were called
girls.
It isn't just the 20th century, is it? I mean, I think of Mary Shelley writing Frankenstein, carrying on that, depicting that story of the mad scientist down in his basement pursuing the secret of life, discovering the secret of life,
right.
and then turning the secret of life into something monstrous.
The story is that at meetings, I've often wondered if
this was a woman's view of science, Mary Shelley writing Frankenstein as a parable about how a woman, or perhaps many women, saw science, pursuing perfection and finding instead the monster that destroys the creator.
Except that that's a story, a fantasy, that has been embraced by many men. I mean, that story, the popularity of that story, Mary Shelley wrote it, but who reads it? Who reads the story of Frankenstein? That myth, that idea that men, in seeking the secret of life, in seeking to the power to create life without women, that's really what that story is about. It's along with many other stories, it's about the co-optation of the procreative function by men. It's a story about dispensing with female procreativity. That's what that story is about. And what does it result in? It results in a monster, not the secret of life, but a monster who becomes the secret of death. It becomes an agent of destruction. That theme is with us everywhere. That theme that was my interest in the metaphor of bombs as babies. But the idea that when men succeed in discovering the secret of life and taking it in their hands, they will produce babies that will be agents of destruction. They will be the instruments of death. That is a cultural myth. That's a cultural motif, and not just our own. It's a motif that you find in many, many cultures. That's a very archetypal story. It isn't only Mary Shelley's story. But stories are very powerful, and they speak very deeply to our deepest anxieties, our deepest desires. Still, there's a difference between the story and the actual construction, technological structure. And I think these stories have had a lot to do, they tell us a lot about the motivation that has led us to the moment in time when we can all but create life as opposed to. We are engaged in this activity, in this interaction with nature, if you will, with natural phenomena. We are seeking knowledge. For what? To what end? Knowledge, we are very purpose of creatures. Some people will say, I think, in the Quintet would say, or many of you will say, we're just in it for the understanding, for the sheer understanding. And that's very beautiful, and it's very nice, and I can really resonate with that. But understanding always has consequences. For example, take the Human Genome Project. The purpose of the Human Genome Project is to give us a complete readout of the human genome. So that is not just for knowledge. Why do we want a complete readout of the human genome? Why not a readout of all the molecules that make up our solar system? Why do we want the human genome? Well, it's not just for understanding, it has a purpose. We think it will give us better control over the genetic constitution of the human race. People say, well, it will help us cure disease. Not many people do believe it. The real purpose of the Human Genome Project is to fulfill a vision of control over the future course of evolution. I mean, that's putting it very boldly. But that really was the vision that inspired the early development of classical genetics and molecular genetics. The idea was to get the future course of human evolution in one's hands. And that's a very extraordinary vision that speaks to a kind of control, a degree of control, that one would not think of having in relation to a subject that one had a more erotic, more interactive, more reciprocal feeling and engagement with. That is control in the Baconian sense of domination. That nature is there to be steered, to be directed, to be, now who are we to steer and direct the future course of evolution?
Very biblical. Men interpreting their mission from God to dominate the earth.
That's right. It is biblical. It is exactly biblical. And scientists have inherited that mantle. But we don't need God anymore because we are doing it.
But as a biologist, are you not curious about what will be learned from the human genome?
Of course I'm curious. I think that, I have no doubt that it will be tremendously interesting, tremendously useful. But I do not think it will fulfill this fantasy. I do not think you can control the course of evolution by getting your hands on the genes, because I don't think the genes are where everything is at.
The public at large, there are people in the public who think that this project is giving us the power to create a perfect human being, down the road we'll be able to connect way back in the genetic chain the potential for a disorder in that child that's emerging so that we'll avoid the crippling disease.
It is the desire for perfection, there's no doubt about it.
And that's driven us for how many centuries now?
How many, and very productively, you might say, but also dangerously. I mean, that in the 20th century, we can't any longer speak of the glories of science as an unmixed blessing. And it's cost us, and it endangers us, and it also empowers us. And the question is whether we can harness this resource, or we can redeploy this wonderful creative resource in ways that would be more productive for the future survival and well-being of humankind.
From our home in Berkeley, California, this has been a conversation with Evelyn Fox Keller. I'm Bill Morgan.
We're kind of running out of time. There's a lot in that tape. What are some things that stick with you with that? I guess one thing I should say is I just picked this person as a guide. There are lots of people out there thinking about these issues. So I think what she does for us is she brings us one perspective. And I think it's a perspective we probably ought to listen to. Questions or comments? What are you going to take away from these particular guides? Yeah.
Her interest in the issue of control, I think that really is very central. It is sort of the control is always in science. It really is the controlled situation, the controlled experiment.
Right.
And that's it is stated, but in fact, I was just thinking, when someone is telling you to do more controls in your experiments, control is almost a word in science, which is really just comparisons. Make more comparisons. If they said make more comparisons, you just say, oh, I can make a million comparisons. But in fact, what they say is do more controls. Did you do the control? Did you do the canon of needed controls? Kind of thing.
Right, and I think that issue sort of brings up the intersection between science and religion, doesn't it? Right. I like that discussion she has right there about the idea that now the scientists have taken on the mantle of religion.
I think it's really complicated at many levels because, and people's personal goals and scientists' personal goals may be different than the total control. Because I worked in a genetics lab for 2 years, and it was studying Fragile X, which is a genetic
disorder.
Mental retardation, which is genetically linked. So there was this component of, the professor I worked with, he really was, I believe, driven by just basic knowledge, wanting to prove this genetic link and conclusively get a clinical test for it. And he was really driven by that. But, he had to apply for his funding from NSF, and you don't know what their motives are in funding this project. And he was also affiliated with the hospital. And so there's a whole clinical and health component to it. And they have different goals. So we were working in the lab, plugging away, doing our science. And what people did with it outside of there was out of our control. So I think he had a very humanitarian or basic knowledge kind of goal, but I'm not sure that it's used that way. Once it's published and out there.
These are certainly very complicated issues, and one thing I heard in what you were saying is, maybe it's a question of how much control do we want? Certainly it's good to have some control over your life, is it? Why do we have this need for control? Why do we go to the lengths that we do to get this kind of control?
Makes me think about who's going to control the controllers. What types of regulation should we start thinking about? I know Clinton was talking about some bill or whatever on the national level. How is this genetic information obtained? How is it used? Are people going to be forced take genetic tests before they can get a life insurance policy? Mm-hmm. Are people going to be screened for genetic characteristics before they're hired? The potential for abuse. How are we going to put checks in place, a break of sorts, to keep the science from just running amok?
Well, I'm not here to pose answers. I'm only here to raise the question. I wish there was an answer. I think you made a good comment here about the complexity of the issues, and I guess one part of my perspective is that I've been sort of on the edge of watching. I've been part of the groups that are looking at ethical, legal, social implications of the Human Genome Project now for, I've probably been at it for about 10 years. And what I've seen is that despite all our talk, people gather at these conferences to, think seriously about what the moral and ethical implications are. Guess what happens with the engine of technology and capitalism? It's just rolling down the hill like Railroad Creek here, and it seems to be picking up momentum. So for myself, I guess I have to say I'm a little frustrated at this point. I really do have a pretty serious concern about, what life will be like in the 21st century and for people's kids and grandkids. But I wonder, you know, what can be done? I mean, how can you make that? How can you make Railroad Creek even move a centimeter or slow down a centimeter? How are you going to slow down Railroad Creek?
One thing that I think helps us to recognize in the process of where science is going is to sort of, to somewhat take it down a notch. And I mean, it is a fundamental value system that's implicit. And it's, well, the thing of the other day is, you know, there's this story of the dinosaurs. They thought they vanished from the earth instantly, and then 50 years later, or 100 years later, they decide, well, the dinosaurs actually became birds. And I think that there's something like that happening to religion and science. It's like science is a kind of replacement for a lot of people for religion. It's what religion used to be, or it's what religion has become. It is a religion, and it's just a competing religion in a way.
Yes, but it's a competing religion that's going to have an impact on people's lives in really dramatic ways. So much so, you know, it's not anymore. It's not about mining. It's not even about a bomb. You know, the bomb at the end has a impact on life. But when we're talking about genetics and messing with genes and what have you, I mean, we're talking about messing with people, right?
Well it has, this is how much power, how much control, how much money will they be able to spend on all of us to do this sort of thing at the governmental level? Because I mean, in Russia, they experimented with all kinds of biological ideas that were centrally controlled, that weren't right. That bombed incredibly badly, like
people starved to death, right?
Yeah, that's
people
right.
People starved to death because of that science and the political.
And so, I mean, I think kind of the science leadership always extremely hierarchical. It's more hierarchical than religion is, definitely. and so at the top of that pyramid, the amount of power that's given there, it shouldn't be as much as the power that's given mm-hmm. to people that are popularly elected and things like that. Mm-hmm.
So what you're suggesting is a specific move that could be made to maybe help things a little bit.
Like casting votes as to what kind of research will be done.
Right.
I think that would be an ethically legitimate thing to do.
But very complicated, right? You think about this isn't Washington the state where there's insurance, and you think about who's going to get the organs? Isn't that not going to raise here from Washington?
Well, I'm local, but.
Yeah, there's Oregon. I don't know. Northwest. So still, I would say it's very complicated, you know. And I don't think there are specific things that we're going to do to make a dent on the engine of progress. So I guess I would have to say, as we move to the last thing we want to take care of here, and that is think about the theme for the week. To me, it's come down to something very personal, that I really have to think carefully about how I interact with the media when I hear stories about genetics. I take it as a personal charge to ask myself, you know, what's at stake there? What's involved, you know, and to kind of really take it seriously. I educate students, so I think I have to think about, you know, what I'm going to do in terms of education. And I think at the moment, for me and for many people, it's coming down to personal choices. That I know many molecular biologists who've left the field because of the engine of progress rolling down the hill. So I think the theme Guide Our Feet is a really important one, in that, you know, maybe in the end that's all we can do is ask for guidance for our feet, and hopefully the guidance that we get and the directions we take makes little tiny dents as this thing moves down the hill. I don't know. So what do you think? What does Guide Our Feet have to do with our conversation about this complex, rather forceful issue? Any thoughts? Do you have any theologians out there? Theologians from religion rather than science? One thing I've been saying all week is that, you know, when we think about feet and journey, right, certainly there's vision involved in that. And that vision is connected to a mind, that what we see is connected to our cognition and our mind. And so we really have to ask for guidance of our thinking, right? And in order to maybe lessen the control, degree of control, we also have to include our heart. So when we talk about guide our feet here at Holden, we need to talk about also guiding our minds and guiding our hearts as we think about these complicated issues. So I have to apologize if you thought you would get answers today. What we really need to do is raise questions and see what happens, I guess. So thanks for your input today. It's been very, very interesting.
Thank you.
So we'll do more of genetics.